From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, getting black middle-class families into Detroit neighborhoods a key to the city's future.
We need to really be focused on how do we actually create middle-class neighborhoods that are attractive to families that are currently here and attractive to new families that want to move here.
A mother's struggle to find mental health care for her daughter here in Michigan.
Unfortunately, it's really sad that with the lack of services that we have to actually consider upping our family and moving somewhere where we can get services.
Native Americans taking their ancient stories to the theater stage.
Native people are still here and we have our own stories, and who better to tell our stories but us?
Plus, Lake Huron Forever, how you can offer your ideas. Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up on today's show, we continue looking at Michigan's behavioral health system for children and teens. Today, we hear from parents who have struggled for years to find adequate help for their children. That'll be later this hour. But first, what about the neighborhoods? It's a rallying cry you often hear when someone talks about the rebound of downtown Detroit or midtown Detroit. Detroit Future City believes a pathway to vibrant neighborhoods is growing the African-American middle class, and DFC's new report explores ways to do exactly that. Anika Goss is executive director of Detroit Future City, and she's here with us now. Anika, this report continues the work DFC is doing all the time to move the city forward. What caused you to focus on the city's African-American middle class?
Well, thank you for having me, first of all, on your show. Cindy, we focused on Detroit's African-American middle class in particular because we were so concerned about the current economy and economic well-being of Detroiters in general. What we know is that 75% of Detroiters make $50,000 or less. We also know that African-Americans are the largest demographic to leave Detroit for the suburbs in the latter part of the 20th century. So those two combined really compelled us to explore this issue further.
How do you define middle class, just to get us all on the same page?
Yeah. So we define middle class as 80 to 200% of national median income. And that ends up equating to $46,000 to $116,000 per year, regardless of household.
And what would more middle-class black families give Detroit? What would it mean for Detroit?
Really, what it does for Detroit is it allows Detroit to lead nationally in terms of growing equitably and inclusively. So as Detroit is beginning to really move on this pattern of economic growth, we can lead the country in finding a place that's inclusive for everyone. So it's not just, you know, younger white families that are moving with means that can benefit from Detroit's economic growth. But what we believe is that everyone should have the opportunity to grow. Even the folks that are low income that are already here, and low income African Americans already here, if we are able to create pathways and opportunities for growth, then everyone can prosper.
And when we think of how many families in Detroit right now fall into that middle class category, what percentage are we talking about, Anika?
So it's about 64,000 middle class families in Detroit, which ends up being about 25%. And what that really means is that that is significantly less than the region and the nation in terms of the share of middle-class households. On average, middle-class households are about 30 to 35% of the region and of the United States. We're really trying to create that balance for Detroit. And that balance would be about 33,000 households.
All right. So that's the mission, then, is to get Detroit, get those 33,000 new middle-class households to get Detroit kind of on the same percentage as the rest of Metro Detroit. So tell us, what is keeping that from happening? What keeps Detroit from attracting middle-class black families?
Yeah, so I think there are a number of issues. We held a number of focus groups. We talked to more than 100 people as a part of the process of building this report. And one of the primary issues are probably pretty obvious that each of them said kept them from choosing Detroit. One of them was insurance, one of them was schools, and then the other is the neighborhood dynamic of renter versus homeownership. African-American middle-class families want the same thing as every other middle-class family, right? Middle-class households. The problem that we have here in Detroit is because we have been looking at all of these issues as solo issues. Insurance is one issue over here. Schools is one issue over there. Homeownership is a whole different issue over here. We don't really see all of these issues as economic levers that actually draw or detract people from staying in Detroit or moving to Detroit.
Okay, so fitting them together is what you're saying. Fit it together.
Yeah, we have to really think about the cost of living. All of those things I've just described add to the cost of living. So while home values are still reasonable in Detroit, the cost of insurance, the cost of property taxes, the choice you have to make for schools all add and contribute to what people believe makes Detroit unaffordable.
If you just joined us, I'm speaking with Anika Goss, Executive Director of Detroit Future Cities. We dig in to the newly released report, Growing Detroit's African American Middle Class, and really what it'll take to attract some 33,000 new middle class African American households to bolster up the city. And I know from the report you've found that African Americans losing ground in income and wealth, home ownership, educational attainment. So the sands have been shifting for people in Detroit through the years. How do you turn that around? What do we do to get the families who've left Detroit to come back and raise up the people who are already living in Detroit?
I think that it's a, well, one thing I want to make sure that we're all clear about is the 33,000 household target is in general. It can be black, white, Latino, anyone, right? That's just the number in general. The African-American middle class should be a growth strategy for Detroit. So what we're saying is that the equity proposition is 27,000 African-American middle class families of that 33,000. I just wanted to clarify that.
Good point. Good point.
All of these things that you just described that are deterrents to keeping lower-income families low-income, and that where people make choices to move elsewhere, like educational attainment and jobs, I think we can narrow it down to a few things. We're still not making enough money in Detroit. So Detroiters are making significantly less with a bachelor's degree than their counterparts in the suburbs. That's agnostic of race. It doesn't matter what race you are. So we have to be able to create opportunities for Detroiters to be able to bring their wages higher. So we need to really be thinking about salary and wages as a goal for Detroiters. The other thing that we also really need to think about are the neighborhoods themselves. And we're already making some strides at this, but we need to really be focused on how do we actually create middle-class neighborhoods that are attractive to families that are currently here and attractive to new families that want to move here. And that's really some of the challenge right now as well.
Because that's, I was wondering where you saw these families living, whether there are neighborhoods and housing stock already available, or if not, then where does that come from?
What we know based on our report and the data that we found is that there are 12 neighborhoods that we have categorized as middle class. And that means at least 50% of the households in that neighborhood are in that middle class category. There are also 11 African American middle class neighborhoods in Detroit, which means that at least 50% or more of the residents are African American and fall into the middle class income bracket. So we know that those neighborhoods already exist. What we also were able to determine is that there are 91 near middle class neighborhoods, and that's really where our opportunity lies as a city. Because if we can, if there's 91 of those census tracts or neighborhoods, then those are places where we're getting, where we can actually stabilize, we can actually create new investment and make them neighborhoods of choice for all families.
So it wouldn't take much to lift those up.
That's exactly yes. right.
When you think of Detroit's progress since it emerged from bankruptcy, is the city at a point where the things that need to happen can happen? Is the leadership team under Mayor Duggan the right one to make this happen?
Oh, I think why we felt like the opportunity to push in this way was perfect was because we do have leadership that's willing to make bold moves right now. And the momentum that we have is one that will say we should be all taking advantage of the same opportunity of growing inclusively. And it has to be more than just talking about growing inclusively. We all need to understand what that is and what it means and how we can do it. I think that the Duggan administration, would agree with that. And I think that they probably are organizing their own resources to do that as well. But I would say, and I think on behalf of DFC, we would say that it can't just be the Duggan administration that does that. This has to be a public-private effort. So there's policy issues that have to happen, and there's also private investment changes that need to be made in order for us to be successful.
Anika Goss, Executive Director of Detroit Future City, the new report that's just been issued by DFC is Growing Detroit's African-American Middle Class. Anika, thanks for spending time with us on Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, the Anishinaabe Theater Exchange in residency this week at the University of Michigan. The goal? Putting on plays written by Native American playwrights and performed by Native American actors.
It's us telling our own stories, and no one can do that better than us. And so that connection of all of that ancestral knowledge that we carry with us as people, and that transcends through the production. And I hope the audience really feels that.
That comes next. Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Sharing our stories. It's how people have come together through the ages. And one of the most powerful ways to do that is through theater, that relationship among playwright, actors, and of course the audience. The Anishinaabe Theater Exchange, the ATE, was created to give Michigan's first people a way to tell their stories through the performing arts. Artists from the ATE are in residence all this week at the University of Michigan, and that includes two performances of a play titled Three Sisters. Here now is Anita Gonzalez, chair of dance and professor of theater and drama at the University of Michigan. She began the Anishinaabe Theater Exchange. Anita, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
And we want to welcome one of the actors from Three Sisters. Colleen Medicine is a member of the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians. Actor in the house. Colleen, it's good to have you with us today.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Anita, just tell us exactly what is the ATE. What is it and what's the goal?
The Anishinaabe Theater Exchange is a collective of people who are interested in telling stories about Indigenous communities here in Michigan and in working with other artists and scholars to be able to share stories and also social issues of the area with the state of Michigan and beyond.
And you came to U of M from New York.
I did.
Yeah, indeed. So what got you into the Upper Peninsula to kind of officially get the idea to launch this program?
I want to give a shout out of thanks to Jackie Minton and to Dana Sitzler, who has a program where she takes University of Michigan professors to see the state of Michigan. When I saw the Upper Peninsula, I fell in love. I've always loved the country, the lakes, the water. And when I saw the power of the water and the land up there, I knew it was a place I wanted to work. There's a lot of emphasis in the University of Michigan to work in Detroit. I feel that the people of Detroit have their own landscape and their own arts communities. And I was interested in seeing what could happen if I would be able to work with people who were in the Sault Ste. Marie region to be able to tell stories about the Great Lakes, which seemed to me as a really powerful body of water. Coming from New York, I had never seen the Great Lakes. And so I even did that thing where you touch the water, you're like, it's not salty. What's going on up here?
And I can't see across to the other side.
Right.
And what led you to the Sault Ste. Marie tribe?
Well, I think that Dana had contacts with the Sault Ste. Marie tribe. One of the things she said that continues to interest me is that the University of Michigan's relationship with the Sioux tribe was not a positive one, because the University of Michigan houses the bones of the ancestors, and she was anxious for something positive to happen in the region, and I thought theater would be a unique way to do that.
So, Colleen, give us a sense of storytelling and what role that plays in the culture of the Sault Ste. Marie tribe and really in the culture, the Anishinaabe culture.
Storytelling is actually one of the ways that Anishinaabe people carry their culture and traditions through generations. Not much of our culture has ever been written down. Specifically, most of it is done by storytelling. And so the act of taking our stories and using theater to give the storytelling is not only traditional in our Anishinaabe culture, but it's also something that I think we do daily.
Daily. And so clearly this idea has caught on because it's gone beyond the Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians to other tribes as well. So it's spreading through Michigan.
So the Anishinaabe Theater Exchange, I think, got its name because of the location in Sault Ste. Marie is Anishinaabe territory. But the actual people that are part of the Anishinaabe Theater Exchange is extended to other tribes across the U.S.
Do you feel that connection between those ancient storytelling traditions and then what is happening when you're on stage with an ATE performance?
It really does feel like the ancestors are there with us helping to tell those stories.
Had you acted before?
No, not before the Anishinaabe Theater Exchange.
What made you say, you know what, I'm going to give this a try. I want to do. What spoke to you?
Anita made me. I thought, what a beautiful way to tell some of these stories and these get these issues out. People really like to watch theater, and so telling these stories through theater seems really logical. It seems like we could really make these issues stick with people. And so I tried it only because I thought how important this might be.
And I think you liked it.
Yes.
Because you stayed with it.
Yes.
I am speaking with Colleen Medicine and Anita Gonzalez with the Anishinaabe Theater Exchange, which is in residence this week at the University of Michigan. Anita, how did you win the support and the buy-in from the Sault Ste. Marie tribe? As you pointed out, and we've explored on stateside, the fact that the University of Michigan does hold artifacts and bones of the ancestors, and that is something that's being worked on. What got you the buy-in?
Well, I think that it takes commitment to working with a community, and I think that I understood that from having worked with other communities. I think that the University of Michigan, it can't be a one-sided relationship. I only worked in that community because I was invited, and it took a while to get invited. I started off going to see one of their elders who wasn't there when I went up there because they had a ceremony they had to do. And so that elder wasn't there, and my husband and I went and looked at the land, which is actually a really good place to begin. Then the next time I went up for another meeting with the community in which we presented the idea of working with the community, and people weren't sure. Then I went back again with another collective of people to sit and talk with them about what could possibly happen with the community. And I thought the first project was particularly interesting because this is the fourth project. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the requirements of working with the community was that it would be a sustained commitment. If at any point the community decides they don't want to do these stories anymore, then it won't be. Right. So, I mean, and I think that's a really important part of community engagement. I think that very few of us who are like PhDs in the university are willing to accept that there could be another kind of knowledge coming from another kind of community that may or may not reject the overtures that we're making to that community. And that's really important. So the Anishinaabe Theater Exchange is the fourth iteration of the ability to have a conversation between the Anishinaabe people and other artists broadly conceived who are of indigenous heritage.
So this week of residence includes performances of this play, Three Sisters. You're in it. Colleen, tell us about the play.
Oh, the play Three Sisters was written by Dr. Carolyn Dunn. It talks about the journey of three sisters who are coming back to their roots, back to their homeland, because their aunt who raised them like their mother is sick and probably going to pass away. And so it talks of these journeys of loss and trauma, identity struggles, all the things that you navigate in families, and especially between sisters. And so there's these beautiful stories of everyone on their own personal journeys and then the journey together of losing their aunt.
And who do you play? Tell us about your character.
I play Camille. She's the oldest of the three sisters, and she's an actress.
An actress within within this play. Anita, as someone who lives in this world of theater and performing arts, what do you feel are the special traits, the characteristics of the plays that come from Native American artists written and performed?
They're all about social justice. They're all about community issues that need to be addressed through the act of vocalizing the issue. The first project that we did was by Mary Catherine Nagel, and it was about sexual violence. The second project that we did was about suicide in some ways, the writing. I mean, these are not like dreary stories. Mm-hmm. they're actually about people sitting around talking and sharing stories about these events, but also like kind of a slice of life, an inside look at the communities through the way that they respond to social issues. So Carolyn Dunn's plays, The Three Sisters, also has that component in it. There's someone who's about to pass on to a spirit world. There are ghosts and characters that live in the past, present, and future at the same time. At the same time, it's very contemporary because you have these characters who are lawyers and history professors and actors who are working within the wider world.
And Colleen, as you think of having acted, discovering acting through the Anishinaabe Theater Exchange, is there a moment that really sticks with you as far as feeling like I am where I'm supposed to be? I love doing this.
I think that feeling comes with every production we have. You get that feeling of connection with the characters, or you relate to something and you have that moment of everything you've done in your life led you to that moment, and then you get to experience that with all the other actors in the play, but also with the audience. And so you're sharing that, really, that connection in a wholesome kind of way. So yeah, I would say every production.
And audiences, particularly as you're here in residence, and you're going to be performing on, we should note that you're going to be performing on Thursday at the Lightbox in Detroit and on Friday evening at the East Quad Keene Theater on the U of M campus. So you're going to be bring these stories to people who may never set foot in the Upper Peninsula. What do you want them to take away from what they're seeing and to understand about Anishinaabe culture?
I would hope that people understand that Anishinaabe people, we're still here. We have a beautiful culture. Mostly, I think the most important part would be to just let them know that Native people are still here and we have our own stories, and who better to tell our stories but us? And so when you're coming to an Anishinaabe theater exchange and you have Native people telling these stories, it's not only meaningful, but it's us telling our own stories, and no one can do that better than us. And so that connection of all of that ancestral knowledge that we carry with us as people, and that transcends through the production. And I hope the audience really feels that.
And how about you? How do you feel as you watch this idea come to life and you see these actors bringing these stories to us?
So my greatest joy is actually in seeing the community of women coming together. I mean, I think it's important to mention that I deliberately chose plays that were written by women to be performed by women. And so I think the best thing that I like about it is seeing the women support one another through the process of storytelling, to share their different versions of what could be seen as the same story or a similar story, but to see the women actually sharing experiences and learning from one another, and then bringing those collective experiences to the stage. The play is just the vehicle for bringing the community together, and the community is like the oracle to be able to share those experiences with others who might be affected by it.
Well, once again, the ATE will perform Three Sisters at the Lightbox in Detroit Thursday evening and then Friday evening at the East Quad Keene Theater on the U of M campus. Anishinaabe Theater Exchange. We have Anita Gonzalez, who had the idea that led to this all happening. She's with the University of Michigan School of Music, Theater, and Dance, and actor Colleen Medicine of the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians. Thanks for sharing your passion with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Making sure Lake Huron lasts forever. That's the goal of a regional plan of action being put together to ensure the long-term health of Lake Huron. It's called the Lake Huron Forever Project. Diane Fong is president and CEO of the Bay Area Community Foundation. It's one of the groups working on this effort. Diane, you're asking the public to contribute to this regional plan centering the concept of Lake Huron Forever. So first off, just how healthy is Lake Huron?
Well, Lake Huron clearly is a fantastic natural resource for all of us in the state of Michigan, especially those on the east side. And according to the state of Michigan, it is in fair condition. So there are some management challenges to our water. There's chemical contaminants that trigger fish and wildlife consumption advisories that we still face. There's nutrients and bacterial pollution that causes nuisance and harmful algae blooms, the muck that some of us see on beaches that cause beach closures. We're losing some aquatic habitat to invasive species such as Phragmites, mussels, sea lamprey, and all of those things. And then, of course, you know, our storm systems, they're becoming much more volatile, and our warming temperatures are threatening our water quality and our fisheries as well.
So there's some major barriers to keeping Lake Huron from being its very best. How does the Lake Huron Forever Project want to address that?
Well, so our project is really looking at stormwater and improving the quality of stormwater runoff because it is the fastest growing source of freshwater pollution. So we are seeking the public's input in the best ways that we can do that through green infrastructure or gray infrastructure. And what green infrastructure is, it's natural and nature-based solutions to filtering our water that's running off into our rivers and our eventually Lake Huron.
So what are you asking of the public?
So we're hoping the public, we have a very short survey that talks about what some of these green infrastructure issues are. First of all, we want to ascertain how informed the public is on this issue. We want to know how much they do know about it, if they're committed to the quality of the Lake Huron region, and then also if they'd be willing to step up and offer their time and talent to this effort.
And how can people offer ideas then for Lake Huron Forever Project?
Well, you can access the public survey at www.huronpines.org/glow, G-L-O-W. And at the bottom, it provides an outline of the project, and at the bottom, there's a link to the survey. The survey will close at the end of the day on February 28th.
I'm wondering, does it ever feel to you at the Bay Area Community Foundation that maybe Lake Huron sometimes gets a little bit overlooked, maybe like Michigan and Superior get a little more of the spotlight?
Well sometimes. And I think part of that, Cynthia, is tied to the fact that the Lake Huron shoreline is really characterized by rural communities. And there's a lot of very natural shoreline on our side of the state. And there's smaller communities that don't have as much experience or expertise in developing some of these green-based solutions or nature-based solutions. So we want to get our lake in the forefront of the public and to actually elevate the understanding of how we can protect those waters, not just in our municipalities, but also among our general population.
What fuels your love of Lake Huron and your drive to want to ensure its future?
Well, my goodness, I mean, my personal love is the time I've spent out there on the water, on the beaches and in the boats. We go to fishing tournaments, and there's people that kiteboard over on Tawas Point. There's so much rest and recuperation we get from the waters, just even hearing the waves and our sunrise. We have such beautiful sunrises over on that, on our side of the state, and we want to protect that.
So ultimately, what do you hope that the work you're doing right now with the Lake Huron Forever Project, what do you hope it'll ultimately mean?
What I hope it will ultimately mean is a very sustainable, healthy natural resource that will be around not just for my kids to enjoy, but my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren.
Diane Fong, President and CEO of the Bay Area Community Foundation, one of the partners creating this regional plan of action to ensure the future of Lake Huron. And once again, you can offer your ideas by going to huronpines.org/glow. Thank you so much, Diane, for being with us.
Thank you.
Coming up, a mom tells us what it has been like trying to access mental health services for her daughter.
Our caseworker at the time, back in April, gave me a list of 62 providers in the state of Michigan to call, and not one of them, and I did the legwork, would accept our daughter with the behaviors that she had.
The length some parents are going through to get help for their kids, that's after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A danger to themselves or others. That's the threshold set by Michigan law to put someone in a psychiatric hospital. But many families with autistic children saying meeting that definition doesn't seem to be enough for their kids, and they don't know what to do. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick brings us one family story.
Douglas Odisha watched as his 16-year-old son, Damien, got off the elevator outside Macomb County Juvenile Court. Damien is pale, with a round, pudgy face and bright red hair. He looks like a little kid. His father says that really, he is.
16-year-old with a mind of a 3-year-old watches like cartoons as a little kid. They got him trained up like a criminal. That's f***ing pathetic.
Damien is on the autism spectrum. He has a host of other psychiatric and special needs diagnoses, too. But at this moment, he's just a criminal. He's locked up at Macomb County's Juvenile Justice Center, charged with resisting arrest. It all started when his mom, Melinda Odisho, called police because Damien was getting verbally and physically aggressive with her. When officers arrived, it turned into a struggle.
At that point, I wasn't exactly worried because I knew that this was something that he has done in the past, until I heard, "I can't breathe."
According to the police report, Damien threatened the officers with a Snapple bottle. He kicked, scratched, and bit an officer. He got a broken finger in return. Melinda has had to call police before on Damien. The police department in Warren, where they live, know he's autistic and has issues with aggression. So when Melinda followed them to the hospital, she assumed they would let him stay in the emergency room while she petitioned Macomb County Community Mental Health to admit him for psychiatric hospitalization. But that's not what happened.
They were going to only medically clear him and then transport him for their processing at their station, and then transport him again to the JJC.
Macomb County's Juvenile Justice Center. So that's how Damien wound up in court. We couldn't tape the proceedings, but the juvenile referee seemed sympathetic. He released Damien back into his parents' custody with a caveat, that the Odishos take him straight back to a hospital emergency room and get him admitted to a psychiatric hospital. Melinda Odisho says they waited there through the weekend to see a psychiatrist.
Looked over everything, agreed also that it is very hard to get a child with autism into any hospital for inpatient services. So he said that he would be better off going home with me.
This wasn't the first time. For about a year, the Odishos have been trying to get Damien hospitalized for his growing aggression. But despite repeated incidents, and in this case, a judge's order, they keep getting stonewalled somewhere in the process.
Once it seems like it's a behavior, they deny.
Sometimes the hospital might look at a child who's on the autism spectrum and think that the issues are more related to environment and behavior as opposed to a psychiatric condition.
That's Dave Pankatai. He's the CEO of Macomb County Community Mental Health. That's the organization the Odishos use to get mental health services for Damien. Pankatai says community mental health has to make inpatient hospitalization recommendations based on Michigan's mental health code. In other words, a patient has to be a threat to themselves or others to authorize hospitalization. Pankatai wouldn't comment specifically on Damien Odisho's case, so he couldn't say why the Odishos keep getting denied inpatient treatment, despite a growing series of incidents suggesting Damien is both a threat to himself and others. But we do know this. It's a common situation. Sarah Mujahideen is clinical director of the Multidisciplinary Autism Program at the University of Michigan.
Children who have these concerns with aggression have limited access to outpatient providers and then even more limited access to inpatient hospitalization and psychiatric beds.
Mujahideen says aggression is extremely common in autism, but it's hard for health providers and clinical staff who lack specialized training to assess and deal with. So many just choose not to deal with it. And that leaves many families with the greatest needs stranded without help, including the Odishos. Melinda Odisho is scared that Damien will end up like so many people with unmet mental health needs do in the criminal justice system.
Overall, biggest fear is that law enforcement is going to hurt him more than just a broken finger.
Damien was eventually ruled incompetent to stand trial, and the resisting arrest charge was dismissed. But he turned 17 at the end of January. That means his next brush with law enforcement won't put him in juvenile detention. It will put him in the Macomb County Jail. I'm Sarah Swick, Michigan Radio News.
And here with us in the studio is another Michigan parent who has struggled and struggled for years to find help for her child. Cindy Sibley, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much.
So your daughter, Jackie, is 19. Can you describe for us her mental health and particularly the type of treatment and assistance that's required to care for her?
She's severely autistic. We always have had challenging behaviors, but when she reached adolescence, a lot of self-injurious behaviors, and she started getting pretty aggressive towards anybody that intervened, property destruction. I have, since she's been two, been out there getting any kind of, we put her on diets. We did ABA therapy at a young age through the Hope Center at Beaumont.
And what's ABA?
ABA is Applied Behavioral Analysis. And it's the one therapy that they found has made a difference in helping these kids. We started it when she was like four. It seemed to somewhat help. We faded out. It was very expensive. Then we were having people come to the home, and I think probably about 12 years ago it was $75 an hour, which now it's higher. Therapy through school and music therapy, we did. We had her on medication, Risperdal, Risperdal, I think it's pronounced. And the problem with that is she was way over 200 pounds, and she started to lactating is some of the side effects with females or boys as well have. And the doctor was fearful. We took her off. This is probably when she was 15. Behaviors just, it kind of held the behaviors down, but it just went skyrocketing.
And it seems the older she's gotten, the more challenging.
Right.
And so she is now out of state, right? She is in Maryland being treated at a world-class facility called Kennedy Krieger. Why did you go out of state to get the care she needs?
Well, for years we were unable to, we have a Medicaid waiver through the state at the time. And she received that when she was about four. The county is supposed to supply help in the home. However, it's very challenging to find any staff, especially when there's challenging behaviors involved. Most of the people that we had helping us would quit.
So you're supposed to get this.
Right.
That's the law. But practically speaking, people wouldn't stay.
Well, and two, the pay rate is like $11 maybe now, which you can go work at a grocery store with less stress. It's very tough.
Work.
Right.
It's tough work.
But Kennedy Krieger, I started researching on my own. I was able to get no help in our home. I was doing it solo. My husband travels. So 24/7, I was dealing with these behaviors, and it was pretty significant as far as cuts and bruises to herself. I researched online Kennedy Krieger, and it was a facility where they would interview you through paperwork, and if you were accepted, you went on a waiting list. So we went on a waiting list for 1 year, and she was admitted last March, March 9th, and they've been phenomenal. They do intense ABA. Medication trials were involved as well.
And who's paying for it?
Well, that was the challenging part. So after we waited on a list, waiting list for over a year, and they basically call you and say, we need you here in a day, because it's like when
slot
a
slot is opened up.
Right. Mm. And the insurance, private insurance, was challenging them at the time, and they said, we don't know if we can approve this. So they called me back and they said, now we don't know if you can get in because we're having a problem with your insurance. So it was a 24-hour period. Kennedy Krieger worked with our insurance. They accepted the case, and she was admitted. So we got right in the car and drove straight through.
So state Medicaid, how does that fit?
Well,
what's your experience been like with the state's Medicaid system?
Frustrating, to say the least. The problem was she left out of state to go to Maryland because there was there's really no place in Michigan for severe adults. And a lot of them are group homes, but higher functioning. Jackie requires 3-to-1 staffing when she has a burst. One of the suggestions was a psychiatric ward. They don't have locks on their doors, and there is no one-on-one as far as watching Jackie because elopement is a problem. They're not familiar with autism. And putting her in a psychiatric ward, autism is something different of itself. And, I mean, you really need to be experienced because a lot of their behaviors, there may be precursors involved, and you just can't drug them up and put them in a corner.
So you didn't see any options in Michigan?
There was none. Zero.
I can tell from the litany of things you have tried and the avenues you've gone, it wasn't for lack of trying.
Absolutely not. I was at my wit's end, and she was attending therapies, and they were like, you can't continue doing this. We even had an incident where the police were called, and they're like, we can send her to the nearest emergency room. However, they're going to send her home. And I'm like, what do I do? Kennedy Krieger admitted her, was able to get her help, and that's when we started pursuing. It was my intention to bring her home with us, but they were like, based on your record of not getting any help in the home, you can't do this. So
she's been there nearly a year.
Yes, and their program is usually 3 to 6 months. So that goes to show you the significance on Jackie's behaviors and the safety that's involved in getting a proper place upon discharge.
So now you're in this situation where Jackie needs to be moved to a supervised facility to come out of Kennedy Krieger, but the state won't accommodate her. Explain that and tell us what options you have.
Well, unfortunately, they canceled my Medicaid waiver when she was placed into Kennedy Krieger out of state because they said she was now a resident of Maryland, which she is not a resident. She is at an institution. And our caseworker at the time, back in April, gave me a list of 62 providers in the state of Michigan to call, and not one of them, and I did the legwork, would accept our daughter with the behaviors that she had. So I started seeking out of state. And the thing is, I have seen the progress she has made with intense ABA. She needs the backup staff. When she has a meltdown, she goes into full body equipment. When she was admitted into Kennedy Krieger, she had a helmet that was placed on her, two arm splints, which a lot of the medical restraint equipment is not allowed in Michigan, knee pads, foot pads, arm mints to prevent because of the amount of injury she does. No place here in Michigan would take her with that. One, they don't know if they can use that equipment, and they don't have the backup of staffing. So when I searched out of town, out east and out west really has facilities that have the ABA. It's just funny because in between there really isn't a lot.
She has to leave Kennedy Krieger. I mean, this was 3 to 6 months.
What happened was our insurance stopped paying in August. It's $127,000 a month to have her at Kennedy Krieger, and nobody's been paying the bill since August. And they're ready to discharge her. They've been extremely wonderful, but they're worried about – they put all this hard work into it. They see the progress she's making, and they can't send her home.
And they've really become an advocate for Jackie.
Oh, phenomenal.
What does this team at Kennedy Krieger in Maryland make of the obstruction that you're facing here in Michigan at this state
level?
They're
lost for words because they have other states that deal with this. And it's simply a switch that Medicaid's not canceled. And if there is some kind of a mistake, it goes back into effect. This, they have never seen it. And they're a witness to what we're experiencing. I mean, they've been getting the letters that I've been receiving through the state and county. And the county, everybody is saying that Jackie needs to come home first before they will reinstate her Medicaid. And she's not coming home is the problem. And one, we're not going to transition her from Kennedy Krieger into our home. I finally made this turn in my life because I never planned on putting her in residential. But it's gotten to the point where I can't do it anymore. I've made this turn and I have like no support. So we have hired an attorney. Our family is just, we're doing everything we can. And
your back's against the wall.
Exactly.
And you've become an advocate involved in the autism community. And as you do this work, are there states, are there regions that are doing well by children who have mental health issues in your view? You look around and
it seems as though a lot of states are that I've dealt, you know, I've met people at Kennedy Krieger. There is still there's a lack of services, I think, but there is other states that are doing more than what we are receiving here in Michigan. I just think that it's not just Jackie. So many families that I've came in contact with, these parents are left with their children. And if they're 16 years old or even boys that are big having these aggressive behaviors, it is horrible. It's just a horrible, people can't do it. And I don't know what they're going to do when, if they don't start doing any kind of therapy or help, they cannot all be institutional. I mean, it's just not fair because I think these kids really have something in them that they can improve. They might not ever be well enough to go out into the world, but they don't deserve to be locked up and medicated.
You are your daughter's legal guardian,
yes.
Your parent, certainly. And we've seen across the country where families wind up forced to make a very difficult and a very anguished decision, and that is to give up custody in order to help a child get mental health services. So basically legally abandon a child to force child welfare, the system, to take over. Have you considered that?
You know what? It's terrifying to me because I have a son. They're 18 months apart. And Jackie, I did everything for her. And I feel like I'm the best person for the job. And you look around sometimes and you feel as though it's giving up. I want her to improve. I want her to be, probably safety is number one. And giving up that is just, it's going to be hard enough to put her in residential, which, especially out of state. It wouldn't be my choice to have her out of state, believe me. I would have her in Michigan, but there is no place. And I'm not bringing her back here and having it go, they can't handle her and she's put back to square one.
Have you considered moving out of Michigan?
Yes. Unfortunately, it's really sad that with the lack of services that we have to actually consider upping our family and moving somewhere where we can get services, and it would be for our daughter. So it's just, I have my family here, and my husband and I both have talked about it. It's just, it's really sad, and it's just not my daughter. It's the whole autism community.
Cindy, what would you say if you were sitting here in a room with the decision makers in Michigan's mental health system? I mean, really actually at the state, at the county, and at the local levels, because you've had years of dealing with them at every level.
Well, places that I've looked into, like the May Center, which May Institute is in outside of Boston, and Bancroft is in New Jersey, these are centers that their specialty is ABA therapy. Their specialty is autism. Michigan needs to look at having some kind of a facility, I think every state does, so that they can house these children that are not just on the spectrum but severe cases.
Cindy, thank you for sharing your story and Jackie's story.
Thank you.
We wish you a lot of luck as you figure out what you're going to do next.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on Stateside, we'll continue looking at Michigan's mental health system for children and teens. Earlier this month, a federal judge cleared the way for a class action lawsuit against the state to proceed. The lead attorney in that suit said the state is failing to provide adequate services for children with mental and behavioral health issues.
Nobody's really against these kids. It's just, it's easy to ignore them in favor of groups with lobbyists and that make campaign contributions and groups that vote in greater numbers. That's why we have to bring a lawsuit.
And that is tomorrow on Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Today's contributors are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Joey Horan, Bella Isaacs, Razi Jaffrey, Sarah Leeson, and Katie Raymond. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.